Welcome back to the program. I'm Zev Brenner. With us right now is Stephen L. Pease. He is a born and raised Presbyterian in Spokane, Washington. He is a Phi Beta Kappa graduate of the University of Washington. He is a CEO specializing in turnarounds, a venture capitalist, and a community activist. He's traveled much of the world dealing with public and private companies, as well as nonprofit organizations. He serves currently as co-chairman of the U.S.-Russia Foundation for Economic Advancement and the Rule of Law, but we invited him for his latest achievement, his book called The Golden Age of Jewish Achievement, The Compendium of a Culture, a People, and a Stunning Performance. Welcome to the program. Thank you for being here with us.
Thanks very much for having me on. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you. So let me ask you, how did you, a born and raised Presbyterian from Spokane, Washington, end up writing a book about 600 pages that's called The Golden Age of Jewish Achievement? And why only 600 pages?
Yeah, I think probably the heart of it had to do with 6 years that I lived in Miami, Florida in 1972 to 1978. I wanted to get a chance to run a company, and if I was going to do that, I had to work with a Jewish entrepreneur in a Jewish business and Jewish industry. So many of my lifelong friends came out of that experience. I had a sense that Jews were disproportionate high achievers. But until 2002, I didn't really have the time or the opportunity to dig into it. I always wanted to. I always thought, geez, you know, get somebody to give me a list of the 100 most important physicists or mathematicians, that if I dug into it, I would discover that a disproportionate number of more Jews. But my mom got ill in 2002, which meant I couldn't take on any more full-time assignments. So nights and weekends, I started digging into this topic, and along the way did a little spreadsheet, which I shared with a Jewish friend and neighbor who in turn shared it with Rabbi Harold Kushner. And Kushner liked the idea, encouraged me. He also encouraged me to explore the why question, which he thought was going to be more important than the achievement itself, which is true. That's probably what added 3 years to the back end of it.
So
it came out of the fact that I've got these friends. It came out of the fact that I got a lot of respect for the Jews that had been friends, including those that had been my competitors and people that have disagreed with me along the way. But I just thought it was an interesting phenomenon. And at the end of it, I concluded that culture was really the driving force, and I thought that was an important message to put out, is that the Jewish culture, though it's unique collectively, its individual features are not unique, and a lot of people can learn from that.
Now, I think you start off the book with an interesting story that I wish you would share with our audience about John Klug, who gave $1 million to the Eshet Torah World Outreach Center in Jerusalem. And your opening line is asking why he, a Gentile, was donating $1 million. Why did he?
Because I think he said he discovered late in life that about 80% of all of his friends are Jews, and he had a tremendous respect for them, for the culture, and he was making a small donation or a small gift to honor them and to kind of let the world recognize what the Jews have done.
What did you define to be the greatest achievement of all that you've went through and all the research that you've done?
It's interesting because I think the greatest achievement wasn't so much any of the statistics. It's the culture that got built, a story. And Jews know this many ways better than I do. Between 1880 and 1924, roughly 2 million Jews arrived from the Pale of Russia, Poland, Russia, Lithuania, all that. They'd been oppressed there. Most of them arrived illiterate. They were thought to have low IQs. Army tests, intelligence tests said they weren't very bright. And yet, within a generation, their kids were 22% of the student population at Harvard, 40% at Columbia, 80% at Hunter College. It's that drive, that encouragement, the importance that they place on education, that's the achievement. It's what the culture is and what it's done. The achievements that I talk about in the book are really just manifestations of what it means to have that sense of values.
I'd like you to, you know, one of the areas that people don't associate with Jews having anything to do with is oil. I'd like you to focus on oil and the Jews, their contribution.
Well, I don't think most people understand that the shells in Shell Oil were shells on a curio box that a family of Jews had in England, and then later they got into the petroleum business. They probably wouldn't also realize that the first pump for a gasoline filling station pump was done by Jews, the Blausteins, who became really the entrepreneurs who built Amoco Oil, which ironically today is part of BP Amoco Oil. So in a number of ways, Jews were heavily involved, particularly in the early days of petroleum, where it was trading, and the fact that Jews existed all over the planet because of the diaspora gave them natural linkages to get involved in commercial transactions for commodities that were transferred all over the world.
And what about Hess? I'm fascinated. He grew up as a son of a kosher butcher.
Absolutely. The New York Jets, for God's sake, yeah. Hesse is just another one of those stories of petroleum-based families.
Did you also cover, I don't remember seeing it, a gentleman by the name of Abraham Schreiner?
No, I don't recall.
Abraham, just good for you to know, Abraham Schreiner was an amateur scientist who discovered the use of petroleum for lighting purposes in Galicia in 1853, while the American discovery of petroleum didn't occur until 1854.
Well, you know, one of the things that you come to appreciate when you do this exercise is that treasuring of education often meant that they went and got advanced degrees in all kinds of high technology, engineering, and sciences, which then positioned them to be inventors and discoverers and entrepreneurs. I mean, if you look at, you know, Intel, Facebook, so many of these kind of high-tech-oriented companies come because Jews have had postgraduate degrees in science and technology, but because of their culture, they become entrepreneurial, and they apply all that learning in very specific ways that are very helpful.
Let's name drop. They say Hollywood was invented by Jews.
That's true. Every studio, every major studio in Hollywood was either started by or largely shaped by Jews, and that includes the Walt Disney Studio. Walt Disney was not Jewish, was accused of being anti-Semitic, in part because he took on the unions after World War II. But when he died, Roy Disney thought the thing was going to hell, and so he brought in Michael Eisner, and Eisner transformed the place. I mean, it just grew by leaps and bounds. And even today, the current CEO who replaced Eisner is also Jewish. But you look at the major producers, you look at the proportion of actors and actresses. It's just the industry didn't really exist. It was really flickers, you know, little short movies that kind of captured your attention. The Jews are the ones who saw the idea of building an industry by producing feature-length films, by building major studios, by owning and distributing the movies. So they took a novel invention and turned it into a huge industry.
Was there any surprise you found that somebody they didn't think was Jewish, who played a major role in some area?
I don't know. That would be a hard one.
I'm sure a lot of them that fit that category.
Yeah, well, and I can, you know, the other one is the guys that I really think are Jewish, but that they have never really done it in any public way. And my point was never to out anybody in this book, anybody who wished not to be known to be that way. But, you know, a small one that people can relate to is I thought maybe Dan Snyder was, but it wasn't until I dug into the book that I was able to find out that he was.
They found that he was or he wasn't?
He is.
Mm-hmm.
He is. He and his sister both give fairly generously to Jewish causes. So, digging in, the Internet makes it astonishingly, I wouldn't say easy, but with a little bit of following your nose, you can learn a lot, and that helped an awful lot in putting this together. I mean, this isn't somebody who I discovered, but for example, because I get the New York Times delivered to my doorway in Sonoma every day, it means that I can read online every New York Times back to the time that the Oak-Sulzbergers took it over, which meant when I was doing my research on the Strauss family of Macy's, I was able to look at the obituary for Isidore, who went down on the Titanic, and kind of read about him, about his marriage, about the rabbi, all about him. It's just amazing what you can find out now, which makes it possible to learn all these things.
One area that they don't associate Jews too much with, even though that's not true, is, of course, sports.
Yes, although, you know, even there, you go back to basketball and boxing.
Boxing used to be a Jewish sport.
You know, they were significant in boxing. They were thought to be, because they were shorter, they were thought to have faster reaction times and be fleet of foot. So the Philadelphia Spas was a Jewish basketball team. These days, they are about the proportion of the population in baseball. They're almost non-existent in basketball. And there's a few who are professional football players. But what they do more than participate is they get awarded in the Hall of Fames for what they've done in ownership, for what they've done in coaching, and to some extent what they've done in playing. And, of course, if you want to talk about owning the major franchises, there too Jews are disproportionately high achievers.
Now let's look at business. A lot of businesses that were so big business that people don't even associate with Jews that were started by Jews, including what you write, Ex-Lax.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, 1890. Yeah. I didn't realize it went back to 1890. Israel Matz.
Absolutely. You know, and like lots of Jews, that story involves a guy who then spent the last half of his life doing philanthropic work. You know, so it happens often that the impulse to be Jewish and discover something because of your knowledge then gets applied. Somebody makes a bloody fortune, and they go on to do, you know, whether it's Tikkun Olam or whatever you want to call it, they are very philanthropic. You know, at the Jewish Book Council today, I was talking a little bit about the chap who built Sears Roebuck, responsible singly for building 5,000 schools for blacks throughout the American South, when he went down there and discovered how absolutely appalling circumstances were. So he came up with an idea. He got a set of architectural plans that were kind of a model set of plans that were built for him at Tuskegee Institute. And then he took them to school districts and said, look, I'm not going to write the check to do all this, but I'll match you, and you can make in-kind contributions. He said this to the black parents of kids who would go to the school. And so he intrigued them with the notion, and he got them enthusiastic about it, and they said they would do that. Then he went out and found a few other philanthropists who would work with him. And then together, the parents, the other philanthropists, and he went back and shamed the school districts into building these 5,000 schools. They're now called Rosenwald Schools in his honor. And he's the same guy who built 25 YMCAs, even though as a Jew, Rosenwald could not be on the board of the YMCA.
And some of the other companies, Starbucks we know is Jewish, sure. That people know today. But I didn't realize Welch's Grape Juice was found by the son of a Russian Orthodox rabbi.
Yeah, I mean, he actually, if I recall the story properly, was a bit of a Wall Street guy who was making a fortune and decided to get out and kind of discovered a co-op that had fallen on hard times, which he turned around and made it into a profitable business. And, yeah, Welch's, another business really built by Jews. Jews, I think by their nature, in part because of the harshness of the circumstance and the inability to rely upon a large organization where fortunes might change or tastes might change, They had to rely upon themselves, and so they became entrepreneurs. They're used to coming up with an idea or taking over a business and being accountable for it. But history has kind of taught them that if you're a cog in a large organization and the winds of fate change, you can't afford to be dependent in that way. So I think they're gifted as entrepreneurs.
Unfortunately, we were geniuses in lots of areas, including organized crime for a while, mafia.
Yes, that's true. Although the interesting story of, I mean, Lansky arguably was the partner who helped build Murder Incorporated, amongst other things. You know, the way by which the mob would enforce discipline was that if a guy got out of line, Murder Incorporated would organize the families to all agree that this guy was out of line, and then they would hire a contract killer from someplace else and bring him in. But, you know, Dutch Schultz, Bugsy Siegel, all of them. But the story, you know, it goes back into the mid-1800s, but by the time Lansky dies, it's pretty much over. I mean, the other groups, ethnic groups that were part of the mob scene, have tended to carry on, but the Jews kind of got out of it. I mean, today I'm sure that there's a few, you know, and some would say some of the oligarchs in Russia share that tendency. But for the most part, Jewish involvement in organized crime died with Meyer Lansky.
Now, before I let you go, you also mentioned you asked a question mark. Is it a fading golden age? Is it a fading golden age, in your opinion?
I think it's a big risk. It worries me. I mean, at the end of World War II, Jews were 0.4% of the world's population. Today, they're 0.2%. They marry older. They have fewer kids. They marry outside the culture. More than half Jews are secular anyway, but they often marry a non-Jewish girl and bring the kids up in a non-Jewish way. And meanwhile, the rest of the population has many people who marry much younger, have much larger families, and don't have anything like the cultural value system. So, yes, I'm concerned about that. Now, Jews
are concerned
about
because the Jews
are back for 4,000 years. So there's a pretty good chance they'll come back. But I would tell you that as a Gentile who has great respect for the culture, it's worrisome.
It's worrisome because there are less Jews around?
It's
well, less committed
because
Jews.
I think achievement is important. And I think culture is what drives achievement more than DNA. And when you see a group of people who have a culture that does it, what you really want to do is, A, encourage them, and, B, get other people to emulate it, and not to discover we're all falling to the lowest common denominator of not treasuring values that encourage people to go out and cure polio, for example. You know, when I was a kid, you couldn't swim in the pools in Spokane, Washington, because polio might get you, and two Jews, Saul can save and solve the problem. So, you know, the core purpose probably behind the book more than any other is to encourage achievement and to look at what aspects of Jewish culture encourage Jews to become high achievers.
And, of course, that's Judaism and the Torah that played, I think, a major factor.
It played
factor.
Vital roles.
Vital role with
but,
that.
But so, too, did circumstance. I mean, I'm
well,
sure
adversary anti-Semitism forced
that,
Jews to be creative.
The diaspora was a big influence.
Well, anti-Semitism forced Jews to be creative and get around the restrictions that they were placed under.
Exactly.
Growing up in Spokane, did you know a lot of Jews?
No, but I knew a few. I mean, I knew a few in grade school, and in high school I had some friends. And in college, when I was student body, sophomore class, vice president, Larry Levy was Jewish. So I had friends all the way along, but not a lot of them. At Harvard Business School, 8 of us shared a common bathroom facility. 3 of them were Jewish. But it was really the time in Miami. I mean, Miami was the place where everybody that I was, well, I shouldn't say everybody, many of the people that I was closely associated with were Jewish, and they became lifelong friends. That's really where I got much more of my insight and much more of my knowledge, or my friendships anyway.
So let me ask you the question. Having been with these individuals, seeing the Jewish achievements over, despite adversary during the course of time, did you ever consider becoming a Jewish individual, Jewish faith?
No, not really. I mean, I have great admiration for Jews and obviously affection for my friends that are Jewish and for my competitors at work. But no, I'm not unhappy at all being the kind of secular Presbyterian that I am. I'm totally comfortable with my values, totally comfortable with my relationships, totally comfortable with my family. But I mean, it's like if I had come in the scene in Italy in 1500 and seen all this great art, it wouldn't necessarily mean that I want to be an Italian because I think I'm going to be a great artist. But it does make me say, wow, that is really something that deserves to be described and discussed, and people need to look into why it is so. And that's my role. My role is not that I am a wannabe Jew. I've been accused of that, but it doesn't really apply. But I just think it's an admirable circumstance. It deserves to be chronicled, and we need to talk about these values because I think they're important in terms of driving human achievement.
Did you come across anti-Semitism while you're doing your research, or people responding to you having written such a book about the Jewish people?
I did not come across anti-Semitism on the part of any Gentile or non-Jew who went after it. In fact, the only time I had a slightly conversation like that was with a Ukrainian who was a little bit mildly anti-Semitic, but by the end of the evening, he was admiring. What I came across much more often was concerned that this book is going to put a spotlight on Jews and that will work to their disadvantage. That conversation I had many, 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 many times. And it's still there. I mean, I've got a cardiologist at University of California, San Francisco, who said, Steve, look, you're always going to face that. But the people who are worried about that need to realize that the people who are anti-Semitic are not people who are going to read this book. But what you're doing, Steve, is bringing an awful lot of people who are secular Jews back to appreciate the people and their culture, and that deserves to be known.
Stephen L. Pease, what's your next book going to be about?
I don't know.
Part two.
I'll do my book tour on this one, and then we'll think about another one.
How about part two? There's only 600 pages. We did a lot more than 600 pages.
Absolutely.
Stephen L. Pease, fascinating book called The Golden Age of Jewish Achievement, the compendium of a culture, a people, and their stunning performance. Look forward to having you back on a future broadcast.
Zev, thanks very much. I really appreciate it.
And we're going to be right back after these messages. Stay tuned.